Serve It Cold, episode 14. Written by Ronnie Blackwell, presented by Dancing Cat Studios.
Live, local, late breaking news. This is a special report.
Police have blocked off Magnolia Street in the Lamar Park development and are investigating the shooting death of a local Catherine man. Police are currently on the scene after receiving a call concerning an apparent shooting, said Catherine Police Officer Andy Thibodeau. Officers who responded found a man's body lying near the doorway to his house. Emergency services was called, but the victim was pronounced dead at the scene by Coroner Tony Parks. The police have not located witnesses at this time, and Thibodeau said investigators had no leads currently. And now, we return you to your regularly scheduled programming, already in progress.
As we headed out of the city on I-10, I pushed Old Blue for all the speed the aging van could give me, and suddenly veered down the 510 exit ramp toward Chalmette. I pulled off onto the shoulder as soon as I could, and intently watched the four cars pass that had followed me off the interstate. Nothing suspicious. No Mississippi license plates, no car with a single passenger. I counted 20 seconds with no cars coming down the entrance ramp, and followed behind the four. Three continued toward Chalmette, over the Chef Montour highway overpass. I followed the white Toyota down to the Chef. It turned right, so I turned left. I drove a half mile to a gas station and pulled around the building so I could see the road behind us but be shielded by the building. After a minute or so, I sent Narlene in for cold drinks and continued to watch until she came back. Well, if there's somebody following us, he's a lot better than I am.
Maybe he's a she. Ever think of that, Jonathan?
Actually, I do think about it, a good bit. In fact, my gender stereotyping is one of my weak spots. No matter how much evidence I amass to the contrary, I still tend to give women the benefit of the doubt.
Well, as long as you're working on it, Jonathan.
I pulled back onto the Chef and headed toward Bayou Sauvage National Wildlife Refuge. After all, it was on the way, and fall migration was picking up speed.
Did Big John Turner teach you all this detecting stuff, Jonathan?
I laughed. Sometimes, Narlene. Sometimes I think Big John Turner taught me how to breathe. Yeah. He taught me all this detective stuff. He taught me how to walk down a dark street with confidence and kneel at an altar with grace. He taught me how to enjoy good coffee, fine wine, and New Orleans food. He taught me that life, anybody's life, is high adventure, both comedy and tragedy rolled in irony. And he taught me that the dinosaurs never died out. They were transformed into angels, and we now call these creatures birds. And I say, it's high time for us to go look at some of these dinosaur angels. We parked at the Bayou Sauvage public rest area. I pulled out a spare set of binoculars for Narlene and unlocked Old Blue's wheel well safe and retrieved my Bausch & Lomb elites. Narlene was very interested in the safe.
Aren't you supposed to have a spare tire in there? What happens when you have a flat?
There's actually one of those mini spare things slung underneath the van. But what happens when I have a flat is that I call AAA, open up the safe, and go birding until the guy shows up and puts on a new tire. I pulled my walking staff out of the van and asked Narlene to hold it for me while I locked up.
Wow, that's really light. What's it for?
It's made from the flower spike of the sodal plant that lives in the Guadalupe Mountains of West Texas. It's my gator stick. I use it to move him off the path.
Yeah, right. Next thing, you're going to tell me we're going to hunt snipe, Jonathan.
Well, believe it or not, Rap, There actually is such a bird. We may see one if we're lucky today. She gave me a look rich with skepticism. We walked through the picnic pavilion to reach the nature trail. The trail largely consists of a series of low boardwalks, complete with handrails, that wander through a very nice oak palmetto overflow bottom. The boardwalks are connected with wheelchair-accessible paths. It was a good day to be birding, and Narlene soon got the knack of using binoculars. She was fascinated with the constant flit of the American redstarts and the falling leaf tumble of a brown creeper. A male magnolia warbler was in full song and gave us a 5-minute show. There were no alligators in the path, but I did get to use my staff to carefully move a freshly shed copperhead that was warming itself in a small pool of sunlight in our way. We were walking along the path leading to the northernmost boardwalk when I heard someone give a startled yelp off to our left. I stopped suddenly, and Narlene walked ahead of me. I reached and caught her arm right above the elbow. There it was again, this time followed by angry shouts and snarls, like an argument in a foreign language. I pulled Narlene close to me, just as a loud scream split the air. I backed across the path, putting a large oak trunk to our backs, and the scream was replaced by the sound of cracking branches as something large blasted through the underbrush toward us. I can now remember seeing the two huge boars rush across that path straight toward us. I can remember that the first one was a dirty cream color, with black spots across his flanks, his snout full of tusks and foam flecked with blood. His pursuer was larger, wiry black hair forming the typical European boar crest, mouth open with bloody tusks gleaming, still set on destroying his rival. I can remember the whole tableau now, but at the time I was somewhere else. I stood stock still, looking right through the now into that damned boat, hearing Paolo Cruz scream his last breath. Narlene's voice in my right ear brought me back.
Jonathan, you're hurting me.
I let her go and jumped forward, arms spread wide, trying to look even bigger than I was, and I hurled the South's primeval curse on any bowed-up dog.
Get back under that house!
At the top of my lungs. The two hogs stopped on a dime, then split up, old Spotted Ass crossing the path not 3 feet from me and crashing into the thick cane. The European boar spinning and hurling himself back through the thicket from which they came. The next sound I heard came from directly behind me, the sound of uncontrollable laughter. I turned to find Narlene holding her left elbow and laughing so hard that she was leaning against the oak for support.
Get back under the house?
Well, I'm just glad it works on hogs, too. Did I hurt your arm? I'm sorry, Narlene.
Don't worry about it. Remember, I'm a trained beauty pageant contestant. This is nothing compared to getting glued into your evening gown. Besides, a friend of mine once told me it'll grow back.
We walked on. I showed Narlene where the hogs had been rooting in the lakeside mud. The last boardwalk took us through the transitional zone to the edge of the lake. We sat on a bench, and I tried to get my heart rate down to something resembling normal, while I pointed out the waiting birds around us. A large flight of white ibis sailed in from the east and landed among a line of foraging snowy egrets. Soon little blue and tricolor herons joined them. A trio of roseate spoonbills appeared to trail the moving line of waders. 4 great blue herons overflew the line to take advantage of the fish fleeing from the smaller birds. As Narlene watched the feeding frenzy in front of us, she said,
"You were right. They are dinosaurs, aren't they?"
"Absolutely."
"The pink ones? The spoonbills? They are so beautiful. I never knew we had such exotic birds in America. Jonathan, back there with the hogs, were you scared?"
"Absolutely again. Wild hogs are by far the most dangerous animals you'll ever run into in a swamp. More dangerous than bears or snakes." She was quiet for a while, and then said,
"Jonathan, you weren't scared of the hogs, were you?"
I turned toward her, and saw that she was holding her arm where I grabbed her. I felt the water welling in my tear ducts. "Marlene, I'm so sorry I hurt you."
"Jonathan, you didn't hurt me. You kept me from running straight into that big white hog. But I want to know what was happening back there. You were shaking all over and had a hold of me like a vise. Then you just snapped out of it and ran the hogs away with your little flower stick. Now, you didn't hurt me, but if I am your friend, you'll tell me what's going on. If I'm not your friend, then hell yes, you've hurt me. But not by grabbing my arm.
I whistled. Damn, Arlene. You're really talented with that emotional blackmail stuff. Are you sure you're not really 40 years old? She was staring straight ahead. She didn't even start to smile.
Jonathan, it's about Big John and the drug smuggling thing, isn't it? Listen, damn you. You've made me tell my fucking story 4 or 5 times now. I know what you're doing with that. Well, if it's good for me, why isn't it good for you?
She had me there, but good. I said, I stand by my 40-year-old statement, but you're right. I'll tell you my story. Let's wait until we get back to the van. I can show you where some of this story happened.
Are you blowing me off, Jonathan?
No, I'm not. But, Narlene, I don't want to get rid of my nightmares by just handing them off to you.
You no good motherfucking son of a bitch. Do you think I'm going to let you sit here and condescend to me and treat me like some frail little woman who has to be protected from the big bad world?
Okay. I promise I'll do it. Quick, look up. A squadron of 6 wood storks was soaring into the lake from the north. They landed in the pool in front of us, dwarfing even the great blues. They quickly set to work, rhythmically swinging their long beaks through water as they searched for food. Barring an out-of-season eagle, things wouldn't get any more spectacular than this. It was time to go. Back at the picnic pavilion, I stowed our stuff in the car while Narlene ducked into the bathroom with one of her shopping bags. When she emerged, she was still a blonde, but she was once again 19 going on 20, and dressed in very nice adventure wear, including low-top hikers. I said, "Wait a minute. What did you do with Rapunzel?" She swung her head around, bringing her hair over her right shoulder.
"She's still here, just younger. I was afraid my wrinkles were about to melt anyway. And if you are going to get me killed by wild animals out here, I'll be damned if I'm going to die looking like a stranger."
"I see that Banana Republic did a good job outfitting you today."
"Eddie Bauer helped a little. Those Tommies are true power shoppers. And Tommy, too, warned me that you would end up dragging my ass through the swamp before heading home. I didn't even think about changing clothes, though, till we were halfway out to the lake."
We hit the road, with me playing tour guide as usual. This is what New Orleanians call the Chef Montour Highway, the Chef. It wanders from Gentilly, which is far lakeside of the French Quarter, down to here and across the lower end of Lake Pontchartrain. Right here, both Highway 90 and Highway 11 are following the Chef. Up here just a little bit, Highway 11 will split off and cross the lake to Slidell. This highway gets its name from the little strip of land that forms the bottom shore of Lake Pontchartrain, the Chef Montour. Chef, C-H-E-F, just like the chef at a restaurant, literally means top fiddle, the first chair violin in an orchestra or a leader. Montour means liar. So I guess Chef Montour translates to something like King of the Liars. I don't know where it got its name, but it's an interesting place. When we crossed Chef Pass onto Chef Montour, I pointed out the ruins of Fort Macomb. Then we drove past the dozens of Chef Montour fish camps, most with clever names tacked to mailboxes or on small wooden signs. I pointed out one that was actually called King Liar, another named Chief Liar. Soon I pulled into the parking lot at Fort Pike. We parked and climbed to the top of a berm sheltering the old fort. The whole complex tangle of the Rigolet's confluence was spread out before us. The two forts, Pike and Macomb, guarded the two entrances onto the lake. The one we already crossed is Chef Montour Pass. The one on the other side of Fort Pike here is the Rigolet's. The Rigolet's empties into a large body of water to the south, known as Lake Bourne, and the Mississippi Sound is to the east of Lake Bourne. The water right in front of us here is the mouth of Lake Catherine, which is over to our right.
Like our town, Catherine?
Yes, just like our town. Lake Catherine flows into Lake Bourne through that channel you can see right there flowing through the marsh. That's called Sawmill Pass. Now, if you look with your binoculars way over that way, you can see what looks like an old fisherman's shack. That's the West Rigolets Lighthouse. Behind that is Double Bayou, and miles of salt marsh and cypress swamp. And that ends our geography lesson. I must warn you that much of what I've just told you might be totally wrong. The one thing that is sure is that I have definitely flunked the real-life Rigolets map tests. Now, I think I owe you a story, don't I? I turned and walked to a bench that looked over the marsh at the mouth of Lake Catherine. Narlene followed and sat beside me. Narlene, you don't know what you're getting into here. She just gave me a mean look. You know, they call it the Lake Catherine Incident, or the Battle of Lake Catherine. But it didn't really happen in Lake Catherine. Sort of like the Battle of New Orleans, you know. That happened way down here in Chalmette. False start. I took a deep breath and started again. Okay. It was October, 2 years ago. Big John and a friend, an ex-DEA agent, were working a really big skip trace. Alphonsus Anastasia Alba. AAA, they called him, like the car club. But you wouldn't call this AAA to fix your flat. He'd skipped bail on a conspiracy to commit murder charge in New Jersey, and turned up down here helping out some of his old New Orleans cousins smuggle drugs through these marshes. This ex-DEA guy, I never met him, but let's just call him Deeg. DEA guy. So, Deeg gets a tip from his ex-partner, who is still on the job, that Alba is in town. And Deeg calls up the bail bondsman in New Jersey and makes a deal with him for the return of AAA. It must have been some kind of bond and some kind of deal, because Big John was getting $50,000 for a couple of days heavy lifting, and I was going to get $5,000 for just a walk-on appearance. And you've got to figure that the ex-partner was getting something, too.
Heavy lifting?
Yeah. You see, there were at least two problems with Deeg just showing up and collecting Alba. They knew each other from New Jersey, for one. And two, AAA was often surrounded by big, ugly guys named Vinny. So the deal was that Big John would pose as a crack dealer from Mississippi, who was looking for a supplier who could take care of his burgeoning demand north of the coast. They hatched this elaborate plan to catch Alba red-handed with a load of drugs, and then give him a choice. They would turn him in to the Louisiana authorities, and let him face life without parole on the local drug kingpin laws, or he could go nicely back to New Jersey with Deeg. I was a bit skeptical of this, but Big John assured me that the most informed people would much rather go through a murder trial in New Jersey than to risk living the rest of their short and miserable lives at Angola Prison. Now, I have to say that Big John was not really happy with this whole deal from the start. He didn't come out and say it directly, but he would suddenly stop whatever he was doing and say something like, "Creedmoor, the more complicated the setup, the more things there are to go wrong. And there's always only one way for things to go right." Or we'd be driving along and he'd say, "Creedmoor, you ever think you're bored with life? I'd recommend a good game of tiddlywinks in a den full of canebrake rattlers, for I'd even suggest you go pissing off the New Orleans mob. Generally know what the rattlesnake will do."
What about this walk-on role you played?
Well, after the parties played footsie over cell phones and email for a while, they set up a get-acquainted meeting. Deeg couldn't very well show up, so I got to play Big John's big ugly guy named Vinny. I know. It's not much of a stretch. We rented a Lincoln Town car and drove down here to a little club. It was right down near the Chef Montour Pass, where AAA was doing business. In fact, we stopped right here in this parking lot and changed seats, so I could be the chauffeur and Big John got in the back seat. We walked in, and AAA's three big ugly guys named Vinny gave us each a very intimate pat-down, which was interesting. Because when they found the .38 revolver in my shoulder holster, they checked to make sure it was loaded and gave it back to me. It's entirely possible that I might not have been quite as intimidating as I thought I was. Big John got to sit down and drink some very expensive brandy, while us Vinnies stood around and drank a Beta from the tap. At least the beer was good. Now, while I'm just hanging with the other Vinnies and drinking some beer, Big John, of course, is doing his detective savant thing, memorizing everything from the color of each Vinny's eyes to the exact number of steps from Alba's table to the three doors in the room. All the while, he's shooting the breeze about Atlantic City, casinos, and bars in Asbury Park like he's lived half his life on the Jersey Shore. Who knew? We came out and drove all the way to the Slidell Outlet Mall without talking. We got out there and swept the car for bugs or homing devices. We found none. And that was then the end of my part of the sting. At least, that's what we both thought at the time. 3 or 4 days later, we were back down again doing some work on an insurance fraud case. We got excellent footage of our target actually doing the limbo at the Caribbean Festival at Congo Square, despite his crippling back injury. It just didn't get better than that in the insurance detecting business. We came on out to Bayou Sauvage and birded the same woods you and I walked through today. Then we went across the Rigolets, and Big John dropped me off to bird along Double Bayou, while he came back over to one of the Chef Montour fish camps to meet with Deeg. I had a good morning, and got to our rendezvous with time to spare. There was a pier there that went out through a fringe of willow trees to the marsh and the bayou, like that boardwalk we were on up the lake. But this thing was an old private pier, rickety in spots. I went out on the pier, walking pretty carefully so I wouldn't fall through the damn thing. I just got to the end when I heard a car pull off the highway. I focused my binoculars to look through the willow leaves and immediately see that the car is definitely not Big John's truck. I'm thinking I'm going to have to talk my way off the pier. People down in the swamp take private property real serious, as long as the private property in question is their private property. I started to weave my way back to the bank when I pulled my binoculars up one last time to get a look at whoever I'm going to be dealing with. And there, pulling a large aluminum suitcase from the trunk of his Crown Victoria, was AAA himself. It didn't take me long to decide that I didn't want Alba to find me there on that pier. Somehow, I didn't think that he would buy the coincidence. As he hit the pier, I was already sliding into the water and moving under the pier. As he slowly picked his way across the rotting boards, I could hear him singing. It was my favorite Southside Johnny and the Asbury Jukes song, Love on the Wrong Side of Town. Bye-bye, baby, our love is tumbling down. I can't be hanging around. Love on the wrong side of town. I thought to myself, see there, Big John? You're not the only Southerner who knows the Jersey Shore. I might not know the strip joints, but I got the music down pat. AAA sings his way down the pier, segueing into Have to Find a Better Way Home, as I sank deeper into the water directly under him. At the end of the pier, he pulled a piece of parachute cord from his jacket pocket, passed it through the handle of the suitcase, and tied a surgeon's knot in it. He slipped the loop over a spike and slid the suitcase off the pier. It hung under the dock, just touching the water. Alba straightened up and walked back toward dry land. By now he was singing Without Love. He had a pretty good voice, too. I was getting pretty chilly by that time. The water was colder than I'd expected. I moved toward the bank, too, staying under the pier. I had already figured that walking out of the water would be a hell of a lot easier than trying to climb back up on the pier. Alba gets back to his car and was just getting in when I hear another vehicle pull off the road. I was afraid that this might be Big John coming to pick me up, so I ducked out from under the pier and tried to get a look through my wet binoculars. The Vinnies were here, and they didn't seem to be very happy with AAA. I went back under the pier. There was some yelling. I could hear Alba say, I'm telling you the truth. Why would I do something that stupid? Then he ran for the pier. He just made it through the willows before he stepped on a rotten board. His leg came crashing down through the decking not 10 feet from me. As he fell, he broke another board with his knee. I thought he was going to come on through, but he caught himself and crawled back up. He ran another few feet and crashed through again. This time, as he clawed his way back up through the splinters, a deafening shot rang out, and he pitched forward. his head cracking through the wood this time. I realized then that the guys were standing right above me. Why the hell'd you shoot him? What, you expect me to chase after him out on this shit? Sure I shot him. But you shot him with my new gun, asshole. I gave you the damn gun to hold while I chased him. You're buying me another gun, idiot. You hear me? Another voice spoke up. Okay, guys. We got to get going before someone comes looking for the fucking Battle of New Orleans. I'm afraid that Al here is not going to tell us where the money is. Take care of him. No, don't fire that damn cannon again. There was some shuffling above me, followed by a loud glunk that I took to be the gun in question hitting the water. One of the three gingerly walked out to where Alba was hanging, sort of half under and half on top of the pier. He called back. He's done for. I took out his whole fucking shoulder, and laughed. One of the men standing over me called back. Put him in the water. Let the fucking gators have him. Instead of reaching down and rolling Alba into the water, the shooter suddenly stomped on his back, sending the body crashing under the pier. As soon as the last Vinny tramped off the pier, I moved out to Alba. He was still alive, but just. I guided him into the thick reeds at the edge of the shore. Soon the two cars cranked up and zoomed away. I pulled him out onto the bank. He was in shock and lost a lot of blood. He couldn't or wouldn't talk to me. I talked to him about Southside Johnny, and his eyes seemed to light up then. I took my shirt off to use as a compress, but there wasn't any more blood coming out of the wound. I looked behind us and could still see a Merlot trail through the water. He'd bled out. He died soon after, with me humming, "I don't want to go home." He never spoke. I couldn't help thinking that Southside Johnny couldn't afford to be losing fans this way. Within a couple of minutes, I heard another car pulling off the highway. I didn't even think about it. I jumped up and ran into the water as fast as I could.
You have been listening to Serve It Cold by Ronnie Blackwell, starring Eric Rowe and Beth Wojcicki. Diverse parts by Roger Johnson, Mike Wynn, Martha Holloway, Paul Fisher, and Julia Holloway. Theme song, Where Is the Love by Michelle Malone. You can find out more about her and her music at www.michellemalone.com. Artwork, courtesy of Georgia Godwin and Laura Mann. Serve It Cold is a free audiobook available at dancingcatstudios.com. This and many other fine works are also available at patiobooks.com. For a print or ebook version of the book, visit ronnieblackwell.com or search for it by name at lulu.com. Dancing Cat Studios produces full cast dramatizations of novel-length fiction. We'd love to hear from you. You can shoot us questions and comments by email at dancingcatstudios@gmail.com or start some wild speculation about your favorite episodes at our website, dancingcatstudios.com, or just pick up the phone and give us a call at 206-350-7613. Serve It Cold is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivative Works 3.0 U.S. license. A copy of this license is available at creativecommons.org. Ronnie would be delighted for you to share episodes of this work as often as you like, with as many people as you like, provided, of course, that you give credit where credit is due, you do not charge any fee, you do not use any part of an episode to create something new, and you only copy episodes in their entirety. Some sound effects are courtesy of the Free Sound Project. Direct links and complete credits can be found at dancingcatstudios.com.